rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Happy New Year's. It is the last day, well, it's not the last day of the year, but it's our last show of this year. I will be doing a live program on Monday, on New Year's Day. I'll be here live, taking your calls and talking with you, and should be an interesting day. We're working up what we're going to have. Today, first hour, of course, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be with us. Helen Krebel will be with us in the second hour. She is a conservative. We're going to be talking about immigration policy. And in our third hour, we're going to be writing a new book on the air, the Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion, which will be a book that I have coming out next fall. And we're writing it chapter by chapter on the air. We'll be doing that in the third hour of the program today. But right now, it's time to start our Brunch with Bernie segment for going on 3 years now. What was Congressman Bernie Sanders is now Senator-elect Bernie Sanders is with us every Friday to answer your questions on the air. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. And by the way, a tip of the hat and a hello to Al Franken's listeners. Al will be back next week. But our program also filling in for him this week and the week before as well. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
I'll be with you.
Great to have you here with us, Bernie. You and I were talking before we went on the air and about how useful it would be if our listeners could start having some actually realistic insight and understanding of how the process works, how the sausage is made in the sausage factory of Congress.
Well, I figure if they could help you write a book, they can help the Congress pass good legislation. What do you
there
think
you
about
go.
That?
It sounds like a plan. So tell us about, you know, what...
Well, here's what I think. Here's what I think, Tom. I think many of the listeners understand that in President Bush, we have the most reactionary and incompetent and perhaps corrupt administration in the modern history of America. We understand that. And we can beat them up every week, and that's fine, and that's a worthwhile effort. But I think what we want to try to do is focus attention on what the real issues are facing America and how, in fact, the Congress can go forward in addressing them and what role ordinary citizens can play in pushing the Congress to do the right thing against the very, very powerful special interests which dominate what goes on Capitol Hill. So let me just tick off some of the issues that are going to be coming up and some of the nuances of the legislation that we'll be seeing. All right, for a start, very few people disagree that our health care system is disintegrating or that we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. What the Democrats will be bringing up very shortly is an effort to deal with the disastrous prescription drug Medicare Part D program. And the goal there is to have the government negotiate lower prices with the pharmaceutical industry and then to fill in the so-called donut hole in which seniors are forced to pay 100% out of pocket. That is a very, very important issue. The drug companies are going to be using all of their clout. And let me restate what I've said on this program before, that of all of the greedy special interests on Capitol Hill, the pharmaceutical industry is in a world of its own. Incredible money, incredible power, incredible number of lobbyists. So we have to focus on that issue. But beyond that, even if we're successful in taking on the drug companies there, there is the issue of why Americans pay by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. I think the short-term solution there is what we call reimportation, and that is forcing the drug companies to sell the American people medicine for the same price that they're selling it in Canada or in Europe. There is some question whether the Democrats' upper leadership is prepared to go there. Some are. There may be a struggle over that one. So we would very much appreciate grassroots support for that effort, which will substantially lower prescription drug costs, not just for seniors, but for all Americans. Okay, then in terms of the economy, the overriding issue is that George Bush clearly is not quite right when he talks about us living in a great and strong economy. The reality is that the middle class is shrinking, poverty is growing, and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. That's the overview. How do you address that one? Well, raising the minimum wage is a very good start. The fact that the Republican leadership has not raised the minimum wage for 9 years, it remains nationally at $5.15 an hour, is an obscenity. Democrats will raise it to $7.25. Bush will try it and his friends pile on some tax breaks for their wealthy friends. Hopefully we can defeat that and raise the minimum wage and keep raising it over years to a living wage. That is important because it begins to address the issue of poverty. But the more important issue, in my view, and you and I, of course, have discussed this a whole lot, is our trade policy. Mm. On that issue, you're going to see splits in both parties. You're going to see a number of us, I'm an independent working with progressive Democrats and some conservative Republicans saying our current trade policies, NAFTA, PNTR with China, CAFTA, are not working. And I think the evidence is overwhelming. That is the case. What do you do? That's hard stuff. But we've got to focus on that. There are some short-term solutions, long-term solutions. Bottom line is that globalization is not working for the average American. It is working for the CEOs of large corporations. People have got to keep an eye on that one. What's interesting about that one, Tom, is you're going to see, I think, differences of opinion within the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Bush, of course, will continue to push the corporate agenda of unfettered free trade, which is a disaster for workers. On that issue, we really need the support of working people all over this country to say very clearly that it is not good public policy for American workers to be thrown out onto the streets as companies move to China and so forth and so on. Next big broad issue that we have to deal with, we have no alternative, of course, is global warming and environmental degradation. Again, in the Bush administration, you got a disaster, and I think the Democrats will be a lot stronger. I'm on the Environmental Committee with Barbara Boxer of California. We look forward to some very strong legislation there, global warming. The goal here is, I think, to move in a very, very big way, whether it's a new Apollo program, as some people call it, to take advantage of the new technologies that are out there in terms of solar, wind, biofuels, hydrogen, geothermal, and so forth and so on. And in the process, not only wean us off of Mideast oil and fossil fuels in general, but move us big time to sustainable energy. And that's an area that I'll be playing a leading role on. And the goal is not only to protect the environment and reverse global warming, the goal, of course, is to try to create jobs as well. But this is clearly just a huge issue that the Congress has got to work on. There will be opposition, a lot from right-wing Republicans, some from Democrats as well. But people have got to be involved in that issue. Last issue that I would – the two other issues that are out there that I think people will be seeing discussions on and should be involved in, and that is the need for – tax reform. If we are serious, for example, about increasing funding for our veterans who have long been neglected, for our kids where we have a disastrous child care situation, underfunding of Head Start, lack of Pell Grant funding and scholarships for middle-class families who are trying to send their kids to college, et cetera, et cetera, that requires funding. Where are those money's going to come from? And that requires us then to take a look at the tax breaks and the corporate welfare that Bush and others have been giving to the wealthiest people in this country and large corporations for many, many years. The bottom line is that I think we can recapture tens and tens of billions of dollars by rescinding the tax breaks that Bush gave to the wealthiest 1%, doing away with a lot of corporate welfare that goes to the oil companies or the large corporations, and then use that money to fund the needs of our kids, who now in America today we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any country on earth, and that's something that has to be dealt with, and many other longstanding social needs. So it's a two. You got to look at both sides of the equation. We have to address the needs faced by the kids, faced by seniors, faced by veterans, middle class families, but at the same time we have got to increase funding by doing away with tax breaks and corporate welfare. And two other issues obviously are out there, and that is Iraq, and we got to move very quickly on that. It's not enough to say that Bush's idea of a quote-unquote surge is beyond comprehension and totally absurd. How do we bring the troops home? How do we use the budget to bring our troops home as soon as possible? And the last issue that I hope that people will be focusing on as we enter the new year is media in general, because we are not going to have the kind of national discussion that we need on all of these issues and many others unless there is a media out there that talks about these issues, that worries more about the decline of the middle class than Britney Spears' particular problems of the day.
Yeah, indeed. And when we come back from the break, Bernie, I want to very quickly ask you, what is the most effective way that our listeners, the taxpayers, that average citizens can contact their member of Congress and make their voices heard?
Okay.
And then we'll go right to the phone lines. Our number, 866-440-8466-440-THOM. TomHartman.com for our live chat room. 16 minutes past the hour. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. We'll be right back.
Happy holidays. Tom Hartman is your gift from the Al Franken Show and Air America.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets.
Indeed, our Brunch with Bernie segment. It just doesn't get any better than this. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio. Radio supported by you, our listeners. Listen for the local sponsors for the station that you're listening on and patronize them. Let them know that you're listening. And also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com. Or Small Dog Electronics, getting the latest iPods and all things electronics, smalldog.com, 1-800-511-MAX. And Eco Wine, the organic wine company, ecowine.com. Also, just a quick heads up, I got this from Mike Toth, who does our archives, our audio archives, over at TomHartman.com. He said that the Progressive Talk Station, WTPG, 1230 a.m. in Columbus, Ohio, is scheduled to flip to right-wing talk on January 9th. And there's, again, you know, they say that they're not selling ads. So if you know advertisers, who knows? OhioMajorityRadio.com is the website that local folks have put together to try and save the station. So just a heads up on that, OhioMajorityRadio.com. Back to Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, before the break, you were talking about the legislative agenda and how people need to contact their legislators.
Right.
What's the best way to do that?
Well, there are a couple of things. First thought, the Congress has a good website where people can visit various committees and get a good sense of the kinds of legislation that is coming up and when it's coming up. And they can start making phone calls and emails to their members of Congress. I think the other point, Tom, is that people, I think, don't appreciate that members of Congress and the Senate are probably more approachable, at least their staff is, than one might think. And I think that a call to a congressional office or a Senate office saying, we would like to be meeting with the senator about this or that issue. We'll have 50 people out. We'll have 100 people out. Let's do it at a mutually convenient time. Senators, congressmen have very crazy schedules. One can do that. And if you can't meet with a member himself or herself, meet with a staff person. That works. If 100 people come out and say, look, we are concerned about the higher ed reauthorization bill that's coming up because we want to make sure that Pell Grant funding is significantly expanded, or that loan forgiveness is an important part of that bill, that will register with the member if there are people there. So every member of Congress's number is in the phone book. Why don't you give them a call?
Yeah, okay, great. And there's also toll-free numbers and whatnot.
Absolutely, absolutely.
They vary from time to time.
Right.
Okay, Congressman Bernie Sanders, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders is with us. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Ken in Long Beach, California. Ken, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, yes, Tom, Bernie, I guess the question's for both of you. I heard it, well, I guess, Tom, you mentioned this, the almost, well, we may as well call it $2 billion salary of one of these CEOs. Which one was that?
And William McGuire, United Health, $1.78 billion.
Oh, okay, because I've called my local supposedly liberal talk show host out here. I don't know if you ever heard of Mr. KABC, and he checked it. He's supposedly on the web. He said it was only $128 million. Was that the Wall Street Journal reported that, Tom?
The Wall Street Journal reported it, and that wasn't his salary. That was his total compensation.
That's his total. Okay, maybe he's just looking at his salary. You know, the total quote.
Probably the case.
Package.
But Ken, you have a question for Bernie?
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say that $2 billion, Bernie, sounds like that could close. Did this guy sit down and write this prescription drug
Well, you're right, Ken. The issue there, and that's, Tom, that's what, United Healthcare?
Yeah.
Yeah. What this is about is when Americans want to know why we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, or why we spend twice as much as any other country for healthcare. This is one of the reasons. This is money that is not going to healthcare. It's an extraordinary sum of money going to one person who is a part of the middle management here. He is not the guy who is doing surgery or taking care of children. He's the middle guy sucking out profits out of a bloated system. So if the goal is to provide health care to all of our people, as I believe it should be, what we have got to do is eliminate those types of people and put our health care doctors in our health care dollars into the provision of health care, which is why I'm a supporter of a single-payer health care system.
Get rid of the middlemen.
Absolutely.
The insurance company, the health
right.
insurance companies. Yeah, indeed. 1-866-440-8466. Gene in Windsor, California. Hey, Gene, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
My question concerns the term that the Democrats used before the election, culture of corruption, which I think is a very real and true thing that's going on. And I think it's seeping down through the entire country. And I want to know what the new Congress can possibly do to inspire the American people to not take on the same attitudes as the Bush administration. I mean, and personally, I think it's the only way to do is to reward honesty and earnestness and punish wrongdoing. And how is that going to be happening?
Well, Gene makes a very good point, and the culture of corruption is not just Tom DeLay being indicted. It's not just members of Congress ending up in jail. What it is the greed and the no-bid contracts that emanate from the Bush administration, rewarding private companies with huge, huge sums of money as they provide services to our troops in Iraq or dealing with Hurricane Katrina. There is a culture of greed and corruption out there that we have got to address.
And you believe Congress is going to take it on this time?
Well, we'll talk about it when we get back on the air from the short term and long term.
Okay, great. 27 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be right back.
Lonely feelings deep inside. Find the corner where I can hide.
And welcome back. Help you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Every, the first hour of every Friday's program, Congressman Bernie Sanders, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders with us. And Bernie, you were going to make a point.
Yeah, I was. Gene raised a very good question and made a good point, and that is how we deal with the culture of corruption. And I think Congress has got to play a role clearly, but we as a nation have got to play a role as well. What we will be seeing very shortly in the Congress is, I think, the passage of legislation dealing with what we call ethical reform, ethics, and that will deal with the gifts that members of Congress receive and cutting back that or eliminating that. There is a revolving door program. Somebody leaves Congress, they go out for a short period of time, they become a lobbyist, and they have, you know, a lot more influence than other people do. That's the revolving door issue should be dealt with. There's a situation now where many members of Congress will hitch rides on corporate jets for very small sums of money, giving the corporation that has the jet a lot of influence over members of Congress. That should be dealt with as well. Privately sponsored trips and so forth and so on. And all of that is important, and I look forward to the passage of that legislation. But more importantly, we have to come to grips with the huge power that big money in general has over legislation. And that has to do with campaign finance reform and need to move to public funding of elections. So long as the pharmaceutical industry has 1,000 paid lobbyists on Capitol Hill and spends tens and tens of millions of dollars in advertising and campaign contributions, so long as they continue to do that, they are going to be able to push their agenda successfully. So I think ultimately we need to look at campaign finance reform. But even more importantly than what Congress can do as a nation, we have got to come to grips with this mentality out there that it is okay for greed to prevail. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about a guy who made over $1 billion in compensation running a health care company. Meanwhile, 47 million Americans have no health insurance, and the cost of health care is soaring. Is that acceptable moral behavior in the United States of America? I think it is not. The fact that we have the richest 1% owning more wealth than the bottom 90%, the gap between the rich and the poor growing wider, and Bush and his friends give huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country. This is not just a political issue, a legislative issue. It is a moral issue. And as a nation, we've got to begin to come to grips with those types of things.
Yeah, well said. Bridget in Fort Collins, Colorado. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. First of all, Tom, I want to thank you for your scholarship. I've learned more listening to you than I did in history class, so I appreciate
well,
that.
Thank you, Bridget.
And Bernie, I wanted to ask, one of the things that was so frustrating for me when the Republicans held the Congress for so long was that each issue that would come before the Congress had many, many issues kind of layered into it and these 2,000-page legislation and things. And I was wondering, is there any way for the democratically controlled Congress to put forth single-issue legislation so that people like Fox can't spin it and it's just one issue at a time? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yes, I do. I sure do, Bridget. And I think there will be an effort on the part of the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate to do just that. And Bridget makes a very good point. Very often what happens, there is legislation out there, and a lot of things are tacked onto it, which are very bad things, and then you're put into a position of say, do I vote for this thing because it has good things in it, or do I vote against it because it has bad things on it? And it would be better if we could have up and down votes on key issues. Certainly one of those, an example of what Bridget is talking about, is at the end of the last session, while we're trying to raise the minimum wage, the Republicans decided to tack on to that raising of the minimum wage bill legislation that would have given $700 billion in tax breaks to the wealthiest one-half of 1% of Americans. That's an example of what Bridget is talking about. So I think she's right. Let the American people make a decision as to whether their member voted right or wrong on basic issues without a dozen different riders being attached to it.
Jerry in Long Island, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. It's a pleasure to be speaking with both of you. I have a question for Senator-elect Sanders on the issue of civil liberties and legislation to allow warrantless wiretapping. That sounds like even the late President Gerald Ford was opposed to. And, of course, you know, we have this president, in addition to starting an immoral war in Iraq, this president has waged a war on all of our civil liberties here at home with the help of the so-called Patriot Act and now also the Military Commission Act. And then we had Bush's domestic phone spying and eavesdropping and phone call record tracking program involving literally tens of millions of ordinary average American citizens, according to a front page article in USA Today. And now, so this leads me to my question. Now, since this power-drunk president wants the U.S. Senate to codify into law, and Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York has said he's willing to compromise on this warrantless wiretapping legislation that would try to make it legal for Bush to illegally and unconstitutionally wiretap God knows how many ordinary Americans without first having to go to a court and before a judge and get a warrant based on probable cause, as the Fourth Amendment of our U.S. Constitution calls for. Being that the case, I would like to know what you, Senator-elect Sanders, and other senators are going to do to help block or stop this god-awful legislation from getting passed into law.
I can't talk for other senators, but if you check my record in the House, it is one of the strongest in terms of constitutional rights and civil liberties. And I think what clearly, as Jerry indicates, what Bush has been trying to do is saying, look, terrorism is a problem. Well, terrorism is a problem. But you don't have to undermine the constitutional rights that have made us a free country in order to be effective in fighting terrorism. I think we can do both. So I will do everything that I can, A, to protect the American people from another terrorist attack, but B, do it in a way that does not undermine the basic civil liberties that make us a free country. And implicit in that is that if phones are going to be tapped and so forth, there is a process. If the government believes that somebody is involved in terrorism, there is a process to be gone through, going through an independent judiciary to get a warrant. And you just do not blanketly tap the phones or collect phone records of millions of Americans. And I will be very strong in opposition to that practice.
Maurice in Atlanta, Georgia. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, gentlemen. How are you? First and foremost, for the last 25 years, we've run away from the concept of an activist government. So to that end, I wanted to ask Senator-elect Sanders three specific questions. What do you think the timetable is regarding ultimately getting single-payer universal health care? What do you think of the capability of the government to close the loopholes that allow for corporations to have offshore mailboxes, which cost this country $70 billion a year? And what do you think is a realistic chance of getting the fairness doctrine re-implemented?
Good. Boy, Maurice hit three huge issues. Thank you, Maurice. The truth is, I'm an advocate of single payer. I don't think there is the will in the Congress now to take on the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industries and do it nationally. So while I'll be working on national legislation, my belief is the way we're going to get real national health care, single payer or otherwise, is through the states. And what we'll be working on is legislation that will give those states that are prepared to go forward with single payer the financial assistance and the flexibility that they need to do so. And if the state of Vermont, my state, or some other state goes forward and does it well, I think it becomes a model for the rest of the country, and the rest of the country will not be far behind. That's the way I see the path toward a single-payer system myself. In terms of offshore the mailboxes, Maurice is exactly right. Many of these corporations have moved to Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, setting up mailboxes and not paying and avoiding paying their fair share of federal taxes. This is an issue I am going to be very, very vigorous on. I think the Democrats will be strong on it. I suspect Bush and his Republican friends will be in opposition. I hope we can move that as quickly as we can. In terms of the fairness doctrine, it ties into the whole issue of media reform. It is a hard issue. I suspect you're going to see more and more about it. I think it's an enormously important issue. That is not just the fairness doctrine. It has to do with what, in fact, is the responsibility of media who use public airwaves to address the real issues and the real needs of the American people. They've been given a trust, and right now it seems pretty evident that they are not fulfilling the trust that was given to them. So it's a very, very big issue and a hugely important issue. You're going to see a lot of discussion about that coming up fairly soon, I think.
Okay. Kerry in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kerry, happy birthday, first of all. And secondly, we only have about 30 seconds before we've got to take a break. You had a quick question for Bernie?
Absolutely. Thank you both. With the NSA wiretapping, the basic, huge, amassing data warehousing of personal information, what is the Senate proposing to do with the collected data? Is there anything planned about the destruction of this data and any legislation about the use or slash abuse of said data? Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank
well,
you, Kerry.
Kerry, it's not the Senate who has done this or the House. It's the White House that has done it, and it's the job of the Congress to undo it. And I think you're going to be seeing some hearings and investigations very shortly on just those issues.
Great. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of By and For We the People. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator-elect Bernie Sanders with us, as he is every Friday, the first hour of our program. 866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
Old acquaintance, be forgotten and never brought to mind. Should all the acquaintance be forgot and days of old lang syne.
And welcome back 9.5 minutes before the hour.
Old lang syne.
Here at Talk Radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator-elect Bernie Sanders will be senator next week. And I think of Bernie as America's congressman, America's senator.
America's senator elect. Is that
there
what you're
go.
Trying to say?
There you go. Yeah, neither a Democrat nor a Republican. I really, your independence is one of your greatest virtues, I think, Bernie. Anyhow, Tom in Brattleboro, Vermont has a question for you. Tom, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Bernie. Hey, Tom. How are you? Pretty good. This is about your culture of corruption and greed that you've been talking about. I understand a number of no-bid contracts have been awarded and continue to be awarded, some in Iraq, some in Katrina. Some of these have been quietly extended without further bidding. And I wonder, is there any way funding for these contracts can be withheld or rescinded at this time?
Tom, let me answer that with two words. Damn right. And that's exactly what we have to do. One of the things that the American people will be seeing in very short order are investigations and hearings on a whole lot of the policies of the Bush administration that have been pushed under the rug for the last 6 years. And certainly this no-bid contract business to Halliburton and other companies, this war profiteering that has gone on while our soldiers are getting killed in Iraq and while they, in some cases, don't have the equipment that they need, I hope and expect that you're going to see that exposed big time. And then, obviously, Congress has got to take action to stop it and punish the abuses.
Andy in Kansas City, Kansas. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders, my question is, how is Congress going to address the Bush signing statement issue with all the signing statements that he's done in the past and what he will do to legislation that your Congress passes?
Excellent point. In case people don't know what Andy is talking about, what this president has decided to do is when he signs legislation, he says, well, thank you, I'm going to sign this bill passed by the Congress, but by the way, I think the provision 87 on page 39 is not really important, or I disagree with it, I'm not going to enforce that. That is, to my mind, grossly unconstitutional. Congress passes a bill and the president signs it. That is the law of that land. And the president cannot pick and choose what provisions he wants to enforce. Once again, I think you're going to see hearings on this and action on this. Otherwise, you're just allowing the president to run roughshod over the work of the Congress, and that is absolutely unacceptable, not to mention unconstitutional.
Yeah, we don't have kings in this country. Ken in Ventura, California, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Senator-elect Sanders. My question is related to the last two. It seems that for the last 6 years, the president has filled the bureaucracy with ideologues and political hacks whose goal has been to ignore or subvert the intentions of Congress and the laws on the books. What can Congress do to weed out these people to prevent them from dragging their feet and subverting legislation which the new Congress passes, either by an...
Very, very good point, Ken. I mean, a lot of people think, okay, Congress passes a piece of legislation and it's going to be implemented. Well, it doesn't always happen that way. It is quite often the administration can slow up the implementations, can screw it up, cannot implement it the way it was intended to be implemented. And that's what hearings are about, to hold people accountable. And more importantly, or equally importantly, we have to make sure that the people who are appointed to important positions understand what the law of the land is and are prepared to implement what Congress does.
Jack in Stuart, Florida, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Did you say Jack?
I did. You are.
Hey, Tom, thank you. Senator-elect Sanders, it's wonderful that you've been successful, and we all pray that this nightmare that our country has gone through will be over. I'm in the financial futures market, and I want to ask you the same question I asked Senator Levin, and I know Senator Levin is working on this. He has a 60-page report on his website. My industry... has been influenced by the run-up in speculation in the futures markets. The margin qualified investor and contract structure could have been changed to drive the speculator from the floor, but our president has not jawboned, as other presidents have in the past, to protect the real economy from a derivative. Many of us waited for these reforms knowing this derivative would impact the real economy. Ask yourself, who has been served by this kite? Did it buy silence? Did it provide certain Middle Eastern OPEC nations with the money to lessen their conscience on our presence in their world, or was it the demand of these OPEC nations as the Iraq Bush agenda was formulated?
Jack, we have less than a minute before we have to wrap up the show. The question for Bernie.
I think you get my drift.
I can't give you a definitive answer on that, Jack, but your point is well taken. I have long had, as many Americans have had, tremendous concerns about the power of the OPEC cartel, which clearly operates in violation of international free trade agreements in terms of the power that they have and their ability to determine the price of oil and how much oil is being distributed around the world. So it is a very important issue.
Well, there's also this whole issue of people who are making money basically on the making of money, opposed to making money on actually doing something.
Yep.
And Jack talking, looking at that whole issue. Bernie Sanders, we have to wrap up the hour here, but I want to wish you the very, very best new year, and thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, good to be with you, Tom.
For another year here, Bernie. And we'll see you next year, next Friday.
Yes. Okay.
Great.
Happy New Year to everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And to you, too. Senator-elect Bernie Sanders. 56 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. We'll continue with your calls and conversation, news of the day, and also coming up next, Helen Krebel, the president and CEO of the Vernon K. Krebel Foundation, on the topic of immigration. Should be a fascinating conversation. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Helen Krebel is with us. She's the president and CEO of the Vernon K. Krebel Foundation. KRIEBLE.org is their website. Helen Krebel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You are proposing a what you say is a solution to the problem of illegal immigration. Tell me what this is.
Well, I think that we have learned through lots of polling and lots of talking to people that we have to have a good guest worker program in order to have border security.
Why?
A good guest worker program means border security, and I'll tell you why. We found a graph from 1981 that showed that on the Mexican border, the guards were capturing about 1 million illegals coming across the border in the 1950s. When the Bracero program went in, that went down to 50,000. When the Bracero program started to be wound down, it went back up to 1 million people.
But the Bracero program was essentially legalized slavery. I mean, we're talking about indentured servants. We're talking about people who don't have the rights of citizens, people who are living at the whim and under the terror of their employers. Why should we as a people go backwards like that?
I kind of disagree with you that that's going backwards. There are an awful lot of businesses that employ an awful lot of U.S. citizens that are dependent on foreign workers to fill the jobs that cannot be filled in the United States.
That's nonsense.
I happen to be one of them. I almost had to close my business when my guest workers had to go home.
Then your business shouldn't exist.
It works just great if we can fill those jobs.
No. Why should any business be allowed to exist in the United States that requires the exploitation of human beings in order to exist? We have an economy to serve our society, not a society to serve our economy.
some. These people are earning $10 an hour. They have housing free with all utilities free. That's not exploiting a human being. On my property and anybody that I know, that employers do not want to hire illegals, and they don't. They hire people with legal visas. And the people who have the opportunity to get a legal visa are thrilled to death to get that.
How can you suggest, though, as long as we have large pockets of poverty in the United States, we have 13 million people right now who are going to go to sleep tonight hungry. Hungry. We have, you know, some 30 million people in the United States who within this year will not know where their next meal is going to come from. How can you suggest in a country that has large ghettos and large pockets of poverty that we have a lack of a potential labor force?
I advertise my jobs, Tom. I advertise them over and over and over again.
Try offering higher pay.
I offer them $10 an hour. You know, are you ready for the $17 peach? You know what would happen if our peaches cost a huge amount of money because we're paying everybody $20 or $30 an hour to pick them?
How much?
Everybody would
is it
peaches?
A peach orchard that you run, Helen?
Pardon?
We're talking with Helen Kriebel, the Kriebel Foundation, Kriebel.org. Is it a peach orchard that you run?
No, it isn't. I have a big equestrian event center, and I hire seasonal people 6 months a year.
Okay, well, let's talk about peaches for a second. Do you know the economics of peaches?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so how much does a log of peaches cost? At the you know, when it's collected at the tree, how much does what?
Well, the laborers are usually paid between $7 and $10 an hour.
No, but for a log of peaches, for...
Oh, I don't know that. I'm not in the peach business. I have friends who are.
Okay, well, the point that I was going to make, I mean, I had a guy on from a winery here about 6 months ago in California, and, you know, making the argument that he had to have illegal labor working for him or he'd go out of business. And it turns out that his wine, which average bottle of wine, his retail cost of an average bottle of wine is around $18, $19, and that if he was actually paying his employees about $3 or $4 an hour more, the average cost of a bottle of his wine would go up by about $1.50. That's not a $17 peach. A $17 peach is hyperbole. I believe that if we were paying people reasonable wages, a 20-cent peach would become a 23-cent peach.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though. We did a poll on the 6th of November and the 7th of November of 2,600 people and found that 64% of the people that we polled believe that we need a guest worker program, and that's the way to get...
That doesn't make it right, though. There was a time in America when the majority of Americans believed that we should have slaves.
This is 64% of today's population believes that is important piece of our economy, and it's important for border security, because right now you have 1.5 million people coming illegally across our borders every year.
Because people will hire them.
With a guest worker program where they come across legally, you would have 50,000, and then our current border agents would be able to provide 100% border security.
Do you really believe, Helen Kriebel, that if anybody who hired somebody who was in this country illegally went to prison, that there would be anybody coming into this country illegally?
I think that
looking for jobs.
You can't punish people when they can't get people legally. And I think that's we've got to provide
the punishment is in the marketplace. If you are unwilling to pay a wage that will cause people to come to work for you, the remedy is not to go to people who are non-citizens and who don't have the rights of citizens and can't organize and can't do anything else that a citizen can do and use them. The solution is to come up with a business model to say, okay, I'm going to run a business in a way that actually can pay people a decent wage. Whatever happened to the idea of the American dream, the American middle class?
Well, I'm paying my guest workers certainly $16 an hour. When the time you put in, that they get a free lunch, they get housing, they get all their utilities. They have almost no expenses the entire time that they work for me. They fight to get my jobs, and I'm happy to have them because I can't. I advertise as I will. I cannot get American workers to do it. Now these are the same
at that pay.
Pardon?
At that pay. You can't get American workers to do it at that pay. It's like John McCain went out and he said, you know, I paid people $50 an hour to pick lettuce. You won't find Americans who'll pick lettuce for $50 an hour here in Arizona. His office was slammed for a week with people saying, I'll do it.
Well, I'll tell you, my peach friends got together and offered $20 an hour to people to pick their peaches and got no responses. $20 an hour. Nobody wants to be under those trees in that dead heat in the summertime picking peaches.
I would submit they were not particularly effective or aggressive in their advertising, because there's no doubt in my mind that at $20 an hour, there are people out there who would be glad to pick peaches. I picked apples for a whole lot less than that. I could tell you, long ago and far away. I mean, I was a teenager, but nonetheless, I've been there and I've done that.
They were all willing to do it a generation ago, but nobody's willing to do it today. They'd rather be air-conditioned at McDonald's at $7.50 an hour than get $10, $15, $20 an hour out in the fields.
There has to be a threshold. I mean, that's the basic, economics 101. There has to be a point at which people will say, okay, fine, I will do that for that price. Maybe it's $21 an hour. Maybe it's $22 an hour. But whatever it is, people who are employers... And I count myself among them, by the way. You and I both own a small business. People who are employers have to be willing to pay whatever people are willing to work for. I mean, this is just a fundamental. Rather than saying, oh, gee, we can't find Americans who are willing to work for these cheap wages, so, you know, we're going to bring in people who are not here legally.
There's an awful lot of Americans that wouldn't think $10 an hour is a evil wage.
$10 an hour is the poverty level in the United States.
A lot of people, these are single guys, most of them. And they think it's pretty hot. And I think, you know, Americans don't think it's hot. They would rather work at McDonald's or one of the supermarkets at $7.50 an hour.
People would much rather be working $20 or $30 or $40 an hour with a good union job and a tool and die shop. I mean, except all of our decent manufacturing jobs have been shipped overseas by these insane economic policies that we have. And the solution is not to bring cheap labor into the United States with the Bracero program.
But they're shipped abroad. Those companies go abroad to our detriment because we can't get entry-level laborers.
No, they go abroad to our detriment because we changed the rules of the game after 210 years in the United States of having duties and tariffs that protected domestic industries and domestic production, and we tore down those walls from Reagan through Clinton, tore down those walls with NAFTA and GATT and said, okay, multinational corporations, you get to decide the rules of the game, and they decided rules of the game that make CEOs billionaires and make the middle class go away.
But anybody who's using inexpensive foreign-made products and loves them, which huge numbers of Americans do, have to understand that those are affordable because those jobs were shipped out to places where entry-level workers could be had at reasonable prices.
I agree with you. We have not done away with slavery in the United States. We have merely exported it. And now you're suggesting that we should import some of it.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just suggesting that for a good wage, we need to fill people's jobs. And if you middle management doesn't get paid the kind of prices that you're talking about, so you have to escalate absolutely everything on the cost of every product an American buys. And also, there are millions of Americans as guest workers in other people's countries, and we love that.
Okay. Helen Krebel, the CEO and president of the Krebel Foundation, KRIEBLE.org. Helen, thank you for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Good conversation. 16 minutes past the hour.
We died in your hills and we died on your deserts. We died in your valleys, we died on your plains. We died in your trees and we died in your bushes. Both sides of the river, we died just the same. Adios, mi amigo, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all they will call you will be deportees.
All right, welcome back. 23 minutes past the hour. The radio support group of by and for We the People. Tom Harbin here with you. The last day of the year. That we're doing live radio anyway. The last day of the year is 2 days hence. Just a quick reminder, next week, Monday of next week, January 1st, New Year's Day, I will be here live. We will be doing a live program, taking your calls, as we are today. On Friday of next week, January 5th, I'll be in Pittsburgh doing the program live from our affiliate WPTT in Pittsburgh, where we've been on the air for, what, a little over 2 years now, I think. And on Saturday, on January 6th, we'll be in Minneapolis at 2 o'clock, I'll be giving a talk at Magers and Quinn is the bookstore. It won't be actually at the bookstore. They're setting it up. You can contact them for information on where it's going to be And that'll be on Saturday, January 6th. This is all. And then January 12th through the 14th, I'll be in Reno, Nevada at the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival, where the movie Crude Impact, which I'm in, is going to be playing in that film festival. And this is all about our book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and what we can do about it, which Amazon is offering at 5%, an additional 5% off right now. And, well, actually, the movie is about my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, about peak oil. Helen Kriebel and I were discussing this issue of immigration and what should be done. There are so many red herrings here. It just boggles my mind. First of all, nobody's really sure of the exact numbers, but the best estimates are between 30 and 40% of people in the United States illegally did not cross a desert. They did not come in here with coyotes and all that kind of stuff. They walked up to an entry point, or drove up to an entry point and to the United States and said, I'm coming in as a tourist. Here's my tourist visa. Or I'm coming in as a student. Here's my student visa. And then, you know, when their visa expired, they just stayed. So, first of all, the idea that building a wall is going to prevent people from coming into the United States is absolutely absurd, number one. It's just absolutely absurd. Sure, people won't come through where the wall is. I mean, you're going to disrupt ecosystems. You're going to, you know, but what are they going to do? You're going to have people show up at normal entry points saying, I'm going to San Diego to go shopping for the day. And they just never go back. I mean, this is not rocket science. Number one. And number two, it is not about, we don't have an illegal immigration problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem. We've got a bunch of companies that want to get richer and richer. They want to increase their profits, and they want to do so by driving down the cost of labor. It is not about having cheap goods in our stores. It is about increasing the profits of corporations. Back in 1816, I mean, this is Econ 101. And it just boggles my mind that Americans don't get it. In 1814, David Ricardo wrote On Labor. In 1816, he wrote On Profits. These two booklets together with what David Ricardo called his Iron Law of Wages, I mean, basically summarize this entire issue. That number one, when the cost of labor, when the availability of labor is equal to the demand for labor, the cost of labor will drop to a subsistence level. In other words, wages will drop to the poverty level when you have as many people willing to work as you have people looking for work, as you have employers looking for employees. And so, therefore, one of the things that a society wants to do is make sure that there's always a little bit more demand for labor than there is supply of labor, and that's the only way you get a middle class. We had virtually no middle class in the United States from 1830 to 1930. Because the supply of labor, because the railroads, for example, were importing labor from Asia in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. There were the waves of immigration coming from Europe, and it was all helping employers. And then in the 1930s, with the passage of the laws that allowed for unionization, the Wagner Act in 1935, the passage of immigration laws saying, you know, hey, wait a minute, you've got to actually be a legal citizen to work here, things like that, began to limit the supply of labor. What did that do? It produced a middle class. But these conservatives don't want there to be a middle class. Middle classes tend to be uppity. Middle classes tend to speak back. Not only would it be better for the United States, it would be better for the sending countries. For example, Mexico, wouldn't it be great if the millions of people who are here were there being politically active and electing progressive politicians? 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low, you cannot fall, would you change?
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Also, last week in this, filling in for Al Franken on Air America Radio, which syndicates both our programs. Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt. The Republican Roosevelt. A recording made by Thomas Edison himself. Teddy Roosevelt coining the term a living wage. Yep, here it is.
they stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
Wages are subnormal if you can't make a living, basically. He's in industrial occupations. In fact, here's a quote, Rockford, over in the chat room, from Franklin Roosevelt, a distant cousin of Teddy and a later president, Democratic president. He said, no business which depends for existence on paying less than living wages to its workers has any right to exist in this country. Well, back to Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt continues to say, you know, a living wage will vary from place to place.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
But it does have some certain consistent variables. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. You know, things in common from place to place.
But must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
A normal standard of living. Okay, Teddy Roosevelt, what's a normal standard of living?
Standard high enough to make morality possible.
High enough to make morality possible. So you don't need to steal to eat.
To provide for education and recreation.
To provide for education so you can put your kids through school, you can put them through college, for recreation so that you can take a vacation every year.
To care for immature members of the family.
To care for it, to raise your children.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness so that your health care is covered.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age. I would submit to you that today's minimum wage does none of those things. That it's a poverty wage. And that importing more labor on guesswork, on reinventing the Bracero program, is no solution to it. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Sean in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Good to hear. I'm walking on the south side here, going to my job. I'm a field canvasser for Clean Water Action.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I work for environmental legislation. And, you know, I make $12 an hour, and that credit lady was saying I could make 20 picking her peaches.
Right.
I'd like a raise.
There you go. See, that's my point. I mean, if there's somebody out there paying $20 an hour for peach picking, you know, they're just advertising in the wrong place if they're not getting people saying, hey, I'll do it.
I'd like a stand in the race, you know?
Yeah, indeed. Okay, thanks a lot, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to hear from you. Bill in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Oh, great. Oh, Bill, our retired police officer.
Yeah, that's me.
Police detective, yeah.
Always listening, pal.
Well,
have a good
you.
New year.
Thank you, and you too.
Listen, you know, there is a large part of this conversation your guest left out. Historically, what happens when commodities are in great demand and there's no labor for various reasons to utilize, what happens is human ingenuity comes in and we automate that process.
Yeah, exactly.
I said, my relatives were coal miners and the unions were able to build up the wages of the coal miners. That made it possible for the employers to invest in machinery. Mm-hmm. To replace that labor.
Yeah, and there's always going to be that dynamic tension between labor and those things that can replace labor. But just busting that door open with a sledgehammer by bringing in basically what you could refer to as scab labor, by bringing in labor that is not part of the normal labor pool in order to drive down wages is just wrong.
Oh, yeah. It's defeating. First of all, it's subsidizing inefficient employers.
Yes.
And, you know, that was my major in college was Latin American history, and that was the justification for the encomiendo that the Spanish set up when they first came to this country to imprison and force the native populations to work for them and then later to import slavery. We don't have the labor. We have to have it in order to utilize, you know, the land and everything.
Yeah, it's a lazy rationalization. It's just,
right,
it's,
yeah,
it's
that's
just
their,
a rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
The amazing one was, I remember, and this was years ago, so you know, my memory might not be exact. I don't recall. I think it was the Second World War, but it might have been the first. But I think it was the second. When labor was short because of the defense plants and the war effort and everything, and they couldn't get enough cotton pickers anymore for the horrible wages that always paid, what happened was, I think it was the University of California system, if I remember right, they developed a machine that would pick the cotton bud without destroying the cotton plant.
Mm. Indeed. Ingenuity always prevails. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. John in Universal City, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, John.
Hey,
University
I'm
City.
I'm going to make this as simple as I can so even a Republican can understand it.
Okay, good.
Just replace Equestrian Center or Peach Orchard with Cotton Plantation and replace the word guest worker with slave. Mm-hmm. That was the same argument they had to go against getting rid of slavery, is we couldn't find people to pick our cotton. And what it really comes down to is we can't do it and still maintain this tremendous profit margin.
That's right. And my point and Franklin Roosevelt's point was that any business that can't exist without
slave
labor
doesn't deserve to exist.
That's right. Has no right to exist. John, thank you very much. You said it very eloquently. Chuck in Los Angeles, listening on KTLK. Hey, Chuck.
Hi. I just wanted to say Happy New Year, first of all.
And Happy New Year back at you.
The one thing that I wanted to comment about regarding this guest worker and all this debate issue is that I believe that problem that people have been having in discussing it is that they tend to want to make it not separate issues of domestic policy and foreign policy, but they conflate them into primarily just domestic policy, resulting in a foreign policy of a wall on the border.
Right.
And that's no way to fix the problem. It's maybe one way to address a symptom of a problem, but not the way to fix the
No, that's
the
my
cause.
Point. The cause of the problem is a giant magnet that is drawing people to this country, which is called employers who are willing to hire people who are not citizens. And
well, that's one-sided.
If you shut that magnet down, then, well, what else is there? I mean, what are the reasons?
There we go. Okay, you are showing that you're talking about the magnet of being the domestic side.
Right.
Now, there's also a repulsion or whatever.
Oh, sure. The way, for example, with our corn subsidies, we're wiping out subsistence. The way, like our corn subsidies, we're wiping out subsistence farmers in Latin America. Is that what you're talking about?
Our foreign policy, such as corn subsidies,
I absolutely agree with you. You're right, and we should do something about that as well. But as you know, that is our foreign policy, our policy of exporting cheap corn that is driving subsistence farmers off their farms in Latin American countries will be addressed by those countries domestically and internally, if we don't provide a safety valve for them by allowing their people to come into our country. Instead, their people will get together and they will say, damn it, we're going to elect some politicians who are going to put tariffs on that incoming corn so that it doesn't wipe us out, so it doesn't drive us out of business, just like we should be doing right here in the United States on imported goods from China, as we had historically, as those countries had. In other words, those countries will begin sending, the countries that are sending immigrants to us will begin protecting their economy, and they should. They should. This is just something that is common sense. Shannon in Brainerd, Minnesota. Hey, Shannon.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Can you hear me?
I can.
Good. I work for $10 an hour. I'm a skilled laborer. I trained in the Army for 4 years. Did it in the Army. Did satellite communications. Now I'm installing dish network TV systems.
Mm-hmm.
I'm installing dish TV for $10 an hour. And this woman is telling me that I'm pleased about getting $10 an hour for something that, you know, in the Army, I didn't get paid a whole lot to do it, but I can go overseas and do this stuff and get paid $150,000 a year. I just don't feel like getting my head chopped off.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous. And $20 an hour to pick peaches, I really seriously doubt it. I mean, that just, I saw red when she said that, because you know what that $20 an hour entails. It entails a place to stay, and we'll give you a little bit of cheap food, and then we'll, you know, pat you on the bottom and say you're doing a good job. They're not getting $20 an hour. They're getting paid in script like a clownliner.
Oh, it's the old company store routine.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, your little crash pad and your little, you know, meal does not pay my rent.
Yeah.
You know.
Well said,
Does
Jim.
Not pay my house payment. Doesn't pay my truck payment, you know.
Yeah. Yep, yep. The bottom line is we do not have an illegal immigration problem or an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem, and that illegal employer problem is driven by a culture, an employer, a conservative employer culture in the United States, which says that human beings are simply a resource, and thus we have now human resource departments, a phrase that came along with Ronald Reagan, and as a resource, it's a disposable resource. Thus, people who had careers throughout their lives back 20, 30 years ago, now we're expected to change jobs 7 times during our lives because we want to? No, because our employers are expected to consider us disposable. Do you get how weird this thing is? 45 minutes past the hour.
Welcome to our show. We're happy that you're here to hear us sing a song about this crazy year. There was violence in Iraq, trouble in Afghanistan, and Brangelina had a kid and started their own clan. Osama hides, Britney rides, Saddam lost his case. Remember when Dick Cheney shot that one guy in the face?
Welcome back. Happy New Year. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Harmon here with you. Oh, yes, you're in the real free speech zone. There's no RNC passes required. We won't have you dragged off if they're drug off. Or what is it? Dragged, I guess, is the past tense of drag. If there's a no oil, no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. Chris in Salinas, California. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
Great. Hey, thanks for listening to us.
I live in the hotbed of illegal immigration in Salinas, California, the sellable world, and it is a really huge problem and a heavy impact on the communities. But I want to talk about the other job killer, and that is the H-1B visas.
Yeah.
And I go to I use a train to commute to my work, and I talk with engineers and software workers, and it is so true about these guys when they're 45, 50 years old, they're thrown out the door, and they're bringing in people who are from other countries and filling those jobs.
Yeah, and let me tell you how it used to be, Chris, and how different it used to be. This would have been starting in 87, 88. I was CEO of an ad agency in Atlanta, Georgia, and we were producing a newsletter for a company that had it was a multinational corporation, and they wanted us to produce a publication, an internal newsletter, in Japanese, English, and Spanish. So we advertised for somebody who had a graphic arts background and was sufficiently fluent in English, Japanese, and Spanish that they could proofread, thinking we would never find such a person, and we'd probably have to hire 2 or 3 people to do it. A guy applied for the job. His name was Shinji, we called him. I don't want to put his last name on the air. He was born in Japan. His parents were Japanese. He was raised until he was about 12 in Lima, Peru. Although his parents spoke Japanese in the home, he spoke Spanish in school. Came to the United States when he was 12, finished high school in the United States, and now he's like 23, 24 years old. And in order to hire him, I had to get him an H-1B visa. Because, you know, he had been back to Peru and he was coming back. It took me 4 months. I had to go down and personally testify in front of the INS. I had to prove that I had advertised for at least 3 months and that I could not find an American citizen anywhere who had graphic arts ability and could speak these 3 languages. I mean, I literally had to do that. I did it myself. I went through all this in order to hire this one guy. And I got it that, you know, we were protecting American jobs 15 years ago. Ain't happening anymore.
You know, the companies don't seem to want to train their current employees. They say, we'll use them up. Now you don't have the technology or the skills, so bring people in from India.
You're absolutely right, and it's wrong. It is wrong, and we need to go back to the way it was back when, you know, back before, well, this would have been post-Reagan, but it was before, certainly before Clinton, and you know, ongoing forward. It's just I can tell you from experience, it used to be very different. It used to be almost impossible to hire somebody from overseas, and you had to prove, if you were going to get an H-1B visa, you had to prove that you couldn't find an American who could do that job. And we do need to go back to that. Chris, thanks for the call, and thanks for that, making that point. Paul in Santa Barbara, listening on KIST. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Man, first I want to say that you got the best talk show out there.
Thank you.
And I do a talk show here, and one of the things I talk about is there was a story in the L.A. Times back last spring about a woman who came up here from Mexico to pick lettuce in Salinas, and while she was there, she was in a grocery store. She tasted some nopal cactus pickled in the gourmet food section, didn't like it, went back to Mexico to her village, and her husband stayed here, and every dollar that he sent back, she invested in growing nopal cactus. And the government of Mexico matched those dollars. I think it was 2-1. The state government matched it with a dollar. The federal government matched it with a dollar. Pretty soon, that village, everybody in the village started growing nopal cactus. They started pickling it and sending it to the United States, and everybody had their little jobs, and it was a very vibrant little economy there. What I think they should do is force Mexico to match every U.S. dollar, our taxpayer dollars that go to Mexico for anything. I think we should force the Mexican government to match those dollars to create the working conditions for people down there so that they can have their jobs, because most of these people don't want to be here.
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, I would submit that one of the reasons why the Mexican election, if you're assuming that it wasn't rigged, I'm frankly assuming that it was rigged. I don't think Calderon actually won. But, you know, the reason it was as close as it was, if it wasn't totally rigged, is because the pressure valve of the United States, because people who would be labor activists, because they are concerned about, you know, to quote George Bush, putting food on their families. You know, they are the people who want to become the middle class. They've given up on Mexico and they've come here, and they should be down there taking their country back, taking back their political systems. But the simple fact of the matter is that the second largest source of income for that country is repatriated funds from the United States, from people who are here, illegally. And again, I think that we all do a terrible disservice to ourselves as a society and to the people out there who are just literally just trying to make a living by calling this an illegal immigration problem and by vilifying the individuals. And we also pandered all the racists out there. This is an illegal employer problem that we have in the United States. This is a conservative economics problem that we have in the United States.
Paul, well, I think the Swift meatpacking plant is an example.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And we should have absolutely nailed these guys. I mean, the employers are the ones that need to go down. And now you've got, last I heard, these guys, the people who were arrested have still been banished. I mean, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. People being disappeared in the United States of America? That's a whole other topic. Anyhow, we're going to be writing a book on the air in the next hour of the program. My new book, it's called Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And we'll be covering the whole process of decision-making. And what does it mean, the map is not the territory, right after the news? Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Friday, the last show of the year. Happy New Year to you. I hope you have a wonderful, safe New Year, weekend, holiday, week? Monday, New Year's Day, I'll be back here. We'll be doing a live show on New Year's Day, as we've done for the last 3 years on this program. And keeping up a fine tradition, that's what I'm going to do on New Year's Day. For this hour, this third hour, I've written a number of books over the years and have never done this before. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, nobody's ever done this before. We're going to try it out and see how it works out. Barrett Kohler, the company that published Screwed, my most recent book, the War Against the Middle Class and what the undeclared war against the middle class and what we can do about it. Barrett Kohler wants to publish another book by me. This one will be out in the fall of 2007. It'll be out in about 9 months. And the title is Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And it's about the things that I've learned in psychology, in advertising, in marketing, in neuro-linguistic programming, the whole spectrum of stuff
I'm an NLP certified and licensed trainer. I don't need to go through the whole credential thing, but in any case, and we've been doing this for a couple of weeks now, talking about, you know, basically going chapter by chapter, talking the book through on the air, basically writing the book, you know, live, and then Sue is transcribing it and puts it up over in our message board, and people can read it and comment on it, and then we're going to edit it and hopefully have a book when we're all done. And in addition to the writing, last week we were talking about motivation strategies, how people internally motivate themselves, and how we can motivate our politicians, and how politicians and movements and activists can motivate others, and the need for both the moving away from pain motivation, that is the sharp stick, the whoa, look out motivation, that's useful, but how over the long term that can also exhaust you, and the need for moving toward pleasure motivations, which are much, much weaker, but also much more irresistible. That is, they're more like gravity than like lightning. You can't resist gravity, even though it's one of the weakest of the four primary forces of nature. And I'd asked last week for callers to call in who had an easy time getting out of bed, and somebody who had a really hard time getting out of bed. And we grafted the strategy of the person who had an easy time getting out of bed over to the person who had a hard time getting out of bed by saying, hey, instead of just using the moving away from pain strategy, why don't you try using the other person's moving toward pleasure strategy as well? And that was Pete in Madison, Wisconsin, listening to WXXM. And Pete's on the line. Pete, what happened?
Well, it was interesting. The night that I did it, I made the list actually in my head and then reviewed it the next day, and I discovered that my energy was up, my ability to deal with even a couple of somewhat difficult circumstances was up, because I had made this because I had made this list, which included seeing my family together for the first time in a while, which was going to be a good circumstance. And it's not like it made the other stuff go away. It just created another type of focus. Now, unfortunately, after that, my self-sabotaging skeptic kicked in, and I didn't think to do it at night. And the days were kind of ho-hum, and I think the skeptics had something along the lines to say, like, well, you know, this is okay, but all these other things are still bad. And so this also in not only directly helped me with the experience of having a different focus, but helped me to realize a self-awareness part of myself to work on to kind of keep the energy going. And I also, sort of as a tangent to that, am realizing how much when I talk to people about issues, it's, hey, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, which are good things, but they're all moving away from pain strategies instead of, wouldn't it be cool if, wouldn't it be nice if kind of thing. So this helped in several different ways, actually.
So this is called a generative strategy. That is to say, it helps produce more like it.
Sorry.
That's okay. It helps produce more like itself. And most positive strategies, by the way, most, you know, when you learn a new skill, it becomes generative. It produces more of itself. That's great. Pete, are you finding it easier to get up in the morning now?
Absolutely, yes.
Cool.
Yeah.
And here's one of the things that you just said that a lot of people don't get is that we all have multiple parts to ourselves. None of us are just one single homogenous person. We are all different people. First of all, we're all different people in the world. I mean, I'm a different person on the radio than I am with my kids, than I am with my wife, than I am with my mother, than I am with my friends. I mean, you know, we have different facets of our personality that we allow to come out. But there's also within us all these different characters. It's not that we have multiple personality disorder. A person with multiple personality disorder has all the different characters inside them, just like you and I do. The difference is that when one of their characters takes over, the rest of them have amnesia. They vanish. Whereas with you and I, we can actually access our other parts. And so one of the things you might want to ask, and I don't want to go through the whole exercise with you on the air right now, but it's a fascinating therapy thing. And in fact, there's a book about this that Steve and Connie Ray Andreas wrote. Well, actually, there's several about this whole thing. You might want to ask that part of you, or the skeptical parts of you, what is it that they really want? What are they trying to accomplish? And odds are you'll get an answer that has something to do with, like, you know, we want the best for you. And then ask them, well, if you had that, what would be more important than that? And just do that question. Go through that question a few times until you get down to a fairly deep level of, okay, this is what we really are trying to accomplish as a goal. And then ask the creative part of you if it can come in and help brainstorm with the part of you that's obviously trying to keep you safe and protect you and you know from all those bad things out there. If that creative part can come can cooperate with those, you know, ask the parts if they'll cooperate with each other. They'll actually answer you. And and get them working together so that you can have both a moving away from pain strategy, because one of the most important things we want to do is never get rid of strategies. But we want to add new ones, and you can have moving toward pleasure strategies as well. Makes life a whole lot easier to have both, and you become more facile, you become more competent, you become more multifaceted by adding strategies. Make sense?
Absolutely. So you're saying, in other words, that the creative part can help to reassure that part that even if we do something different that doesn't focus on an all-or-nothing strategy, it's still going to create the safety that the skeptical part says. Is that right?
Sure. Well, you know, in fact, right now, I ask your skeptical part, hey, would you be willing to talk to my creative part?
And that would say, sure.
Yeah, okay, you heard that inside?
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
And now ask your creative part, are you willing to talk to my skeptical part?
Yes.
Okay, and now why don't you just ask your creative part if it would just toss some ideas to your skeptical part that might help the skeptical part solve problems even more effectively, and let's say three of them real quickly, and every time one of those ideas just flies by, let your conscious mind notice it.
Well, you know what? Why don't I do this in private, because it's I know you have to move on, and I'm
yeah.
not sure I can quite go through this right now.
Okay.
I'll definitely
yeah.
keep the ideas in mind for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, so try that process and check it out. Thanks a lot, Pete, for
Thank
the call.
Thank you. Peace.
Good to hear from you. Indeed. What happened was another part said, hey, wait a minute, maybe we don't want to do this on the radio, which is cool. Okay, here's our lesson for the day, what we're going to talk about today. The map is not the territory. The meaning of communication is the response you get. These are two fundamental notions that are in some ways interrelated. The map is not the territory. The core notion here is that each one of us has a map of reality. Each one of us has an understanding of how the world is. And it's not how the world is. It's just our map. And every person's map is different. And so in the political realm, for an activist or for a politician, the challenge is understanding what the consensus map is, what the map is that most people share. And some would suggest, you know, the think tank folks would suggest that one of the jobs is to actually help create maps. In other words, you have the territory, for example, of when people die, if they have great wealth, the transfer of that wealth to another person, actually just like as if they're alive, if you transfer wealth to another person, it's a taxable event. So it's called the estate tax. That the estate tax, that word, is the map. The territory is the actual transfer and the tax that's associated with it. But, you know, Frank Luntz came along and said, hey, let's change that map to death tax. And by simply changing the map, even though the territory is the same, the meaning seems to have changed. So this is item one. And item two is that the meaning of a communication is the response you get. In other words, you put out a communication. If you say something to somebody, you know, you ask somebody to do something or you whatever, what you think you said and how they react may be two different things. And how they react is the real communication. So if you want to know, you know, what your communication is all about, notice the responses you're getting. And there's a political side to this, too. And we'll talk about how this all works right after this break. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
My bags are packed, I have my ID, a printed itinerary, a boarding pass, and major credit card. And I'll show you that my computer works. I'll shake my head at all the jerks whose crankiness is making this so hard. So frisk me to check for clues. Tell me to take
what you need to know. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane. Just stand in line and don't complain. And soon they'll let me go.
The TSA song. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I remember Richard Bandler was one of my teachers in this stuff years and years ago, and in fact wrote the foreword to one of my books on this topic. And Richard used to tell some extraordinary stories and had some really cool tapes and there's a variety of sources of tapes on Milton Erickson doing therapy. And well, not just therapy, I mean, just the whole thing. And I remember one time Milton Erickson was telling this story to Milton Rossi, as I recall. I may have the first name wrong. There's a tape that I listened to about 20 years ago, so I'm doing this from memory and probably badly paraphrasing it. But basically, he had this kind of odd voice, and he was an old man at the time in a wheelchair. And Erickson says, this guy came into my office one time and said, you know, Doc, I know that... Milton Erickson, by the way, was probably America's most famous medical hypnotist. He was a psychiatrist in Phoenix and a brilliant man. He says, this guy came into my office and he says, Doc, I know that I should eat spinach because I know that it's good for me, but I hate it. Can you hypnotize me so that I'll eat spinach? And I said, well, yeah, sure, I can do that. And he says, can you hypnotize me so I'll eat spinach once a week? And I said, yeah, if, you know, deep down inside somewhere, you know, it's good for you. Yeah, probably, no problem. And he says, can I hypnotize me so I'll eat it twice or three times a week? And I said, yeah, probably. And he says, can you hypnotize me so I'd eat it every day even if I wanted to? And I said, yeah, if you wanted to. And the guy thinks about it for a minute, and he says, nah, forget it. And I said, why? And he says, because I hate spinach. And that's that catch-22. And the key to this gets back to this notion that the meaning of communication is the response you get. If we're the communicators, then we have to employ multiple modes of communication. We talked about that last week and the week before. For example, John Kerry in the last election, which in my opinion Kerry won, but you know, without getting into the fraud in Ohio, nonetheless, Kerry constantly talked at the level of the head. Everything was abstract, and everything was highly visual. Well, not everything, but the vast majority of it. George Bush constantly talked at the level of the heart. In that debate, the heart will almost always win, because fundamentally, people make decisions. The end of the decision-making process is always checking your feelings before you decide something. People who are highly disconnected from their feelings, or people who have, you know, physical pathologies, brain disorders that disconnect them from feelings, have a very, very, very difficult time making decisions. So it's not what people say they want. This is the spinach story, Erickson's spinach story. It's not what people say they want. It's what they do to try to say what they want. For example, people are afraid to change jobs and lose their health insurance. But they will say that they don't want the government making their health care decisions, because that map has been put out by the health insurance industry. Remember the Harry and Louise ads? The map is, you don't want the government making decisions about which doctor you can go to. Now, that was never part of the Clinton health care plan, but that was the map that everybody got. That wasn't the territory, but that was the map that everybody got. So if we're going to address somebody, we have two choices. One would be to recalibrate the map, to fix the map. The other would be to address what they're actually doing and talk at the level of what they're doing, not what they're saying. What they're saying is they don't want the government making their health care decisions, but what they're doing is they're afraid to change jobs because they're afraid that they will lose their health insurance or a pre-existing condition will no longer be covered. So let's talk about, let's address, let's do something about, let's hold up to the light the issue of the inability to move from job to job and carry your health insurance with you and know that you're covered no matter what, that there's this whole pre-existing condition thing is nonsense. In other words, address how they're acting, not how they're speaking. This is what Ron Wyden did recently when he started talking about legislation he wants to introduce in the new Congress that would require health insurance to be absolutely portable and that everybody be insured. And I'm not endorsing that. I'm just saying, you know, this is dealing at the level of what people do rather than what they say. So how do we know? How can we decide, hey, this is my candidate. This is the guy or the man or the woman that I want to vote for and work for and become an activist around. And if we're an activist, how can we help communicate to other people, hey, here's something you should consider. This is an idea you should look at. This is a story you should know. This is something you should get fired up about. How can we do that? We'll talk about that right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, going through our new book, The Cracking the Code.
Look, hark, a cup for kindness yet far days above land side.
Indeed. Happy New Year. Days of Auld Lang Syne here. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. I remember when I first learned about this back in 1978. I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for severely abused kids and emotionally disturbed kids in New Hampshire. The New England Salem Children's Trust, which is still there. In fact, we started a school for ADHD kids about 10 years ago, the Hunter School. HunterSchool.org is the website for that. And one of the first psychologists, because I was the administrator, I was the guy who raised the money and made the program work, and one of the people that I had to hire was a psychologist for the program, and one of the first psychologists that I had hired was a guy who was very into this stuff, Bandler and Grinder and NLP and all this, Dr. Charles. And he had all these tapes of Erickson doing therapy and other things, and I was fascinated by it. And then I left that. I'd gotten into that in 1978. We had sold an advertising agency in Michigan to move to New Hampshire to do that work. And then in 83, when we left that work, we ended up back in Atlanta. And in 87 in Atlanta, started another ad agency and ran that until we sold it in 95 or 6 or whatever it was. And retired and moved to Vermont and then started this radio program. But during that time that we were living in Atlanta, Louise and I decided to get back into this, learn more about it. And we were taking a course, so this half-year-long course in neurolinguistic programming, NLP, from Life Roland at the NLP Center of Atlanta. Great guy, psychologist in Atlanta. And it was one of these, you know, Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday for 6 months kind of things. And there were, I think, pretty much everybody in the course was a healthcare professional, except for one person who was a real estate agent wanting to learn how to use this for sales. And there was one point, and Louise and I were both in the class, and there was one time when Life, the guy, you know, Dr. Life Roland, turned to me and he said, we were talking about, you know, the map is not the territory, and the meaning of communication is the response you get. And he turned to me and he said, Tom, how do you know that you know, or how do you know when to know that you know that Louise loves you, my wife, to whom I've been married for 34 years now? And, you know, so how do you know when to know? That is, what is it that gives you that moment of certainty, that you know with certainty, that Louise loves you? And I tell the story, by the way, with Louise's permission. And I thought about it for just a half a second. I mean, I knew right off the top of my head. I said, you know, when she touches me, when she walks by and puts her hand on my shoulder, she, you know, anything like that, it's, if she touches me, I feel loved. Now, I'm not going to, you know, psychoanalyze why that is. It's just how I'm wired. So then he turns to Louise and says, now, how do you know, Louise, how do you know when to know that you know that Tom loves you? And I'm sitting there waiting for her to say, when he hugs me, when he kisses me, when he says, I love you, so, you know, something like that. Those things that make me feel loved. And she says, when we have coffee together in the morning, read the paper and talk about the day. And I'm like, what? I mean, I'm not, you know, I drink coffee now, but, you know, back then I didn't even like coffee. And I'd always tried to, I couldn't figure out why Louise always wanted to have these morning, let's have coffee in the morning and sit and read the paper. And, you know, I'm just like, boom, it's morning. I'm ready to go. I've got a list of a million things I'm going to get done today. And I'm like, but what about, you know, when I hug you or touch you? And, you know, what if when I kiss you? Oh, that's all nice. But, you know, I know that you love me when you'll sit and have coffee with me in the morning and discuss the day and discuss things that are meaningful to both of us. And again, we could psychoanalyze why that is, you know, that was something that she did in her family as a kid. And, you know, my mom hugged me a lot or something. Who knows? Doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. So we made a deal. She said, I'll hug you more often if you'll have coffee with me every morning. And I said, cool, I'll have coffee with you every morning and we'll talk about the day if you'll, you know, come by and give me a kiss whenever you leave or, you know, touch me when you walk by. And it's so both of us gets to feel loved. Now, how do we translate that into politics? How do politicians know what we want? Well, we have to let them know. You know, again, this gets back to the notion that we don't elect leaders in the United States, we elect representatives. So we have to say to our politicians, this is what I want. And beyond just saying, you know, here's the words, we have to do it. When we get back to this thing of don't just listen to what people say, also pay attention to what they do. It's very often, in fact, usually more important to catch people's words or to catch people's actions, to see that, hear that, feel, you know, get a sense of that, know what they're doing. And so we have to be attending to our politicians, what they're doing, and demanding specific action from them. I think that's one of the reasons John Edwards went down. I mean, very smart guy. He's got it. Probably intuitively. Went down to New Orleans, and he's like, we're down here working to help people in the Ninth Ward, and we're asking America to join us in this work. That's doing it. That's not just talking about it. And it's also demonstrating the utter failure and incompetence of the Bushies. And the whole conservative idea that, well, if you just turn it over to the private market and get government out of the way, everything will be wonderful. No, sorry, it doesn't work that way. So in the political world, as activists or as politicians or as people who are being proactive, we need to figure out what is the territory that we want to accomplish? What does it actually look like? Oh, we want to accomplish a national health care system, and we think that a single-payer national health care system is the territory that we want to get to. What's the map for that? It's going to be different for different people. For some people, it's going to be, I don't have to worry about losing my job. For other people, it's going to be, well, you know, I have plenty of job security. I want to know that I can pick my doctor. Or, I want to know that I'm going to have access to the same kind of health care as, you know, Bill Gates has access to, that kind of thing. It's okay. Figuring out what the various maps are that people have and then applying and saying, okay, this map, map A, map B, map C, these are all different maps of this territory. And we're going to talk in the language of or show the pictures of or give the feeling of these different maps so that everybody gets it. And then when the communication that you get back is the behavior change that you want, whether it's on the part of your politicians or if you're a politician or an activist, whether it's on the part of the voters, you know, people actually showing up to vote, for example, or getting involved in an issue, you know that you've communicated effectively. It's not about just saying the words. This also gets into the whole issue of how people make decisions, the decision-making process. Typically, people make decisions with a process that includes multiple parts. For example, they will make a picture in their mind of something, then they will have an internal conversation about it, and then they will check out their feelings, and based on those feelings, they'll make the decision. That's, you know, a simple decision-making process, an actual mechanical process. And you can watch this from the outside. You can watch somebody. See them look up. They're making a picture. See their eyes move side to side. They're having an internal conversation. They look down. They're checking out their feelings, and then they make a decision. This is something that they teach increasingly in sales classes, for example. In fact, I remember one time Louise and I walked into a car dealership. This is the year that we moved to Vermont. This is about 12 years ago. And we were leaving Atlanta, and we were trading in our car, and we wanted to get a car that we bought a house that was on a half-mile-long dirt road, dead-end driveway up the side of a mountain, and we needed a four-wheel drive vehicle. And so we walked into this dealership, and this guy comes over, this salesman, right? He comes over and introduces himself, and then he says to me, he says, would you like something to drink? And I said, sure. And he said, well, I've got Coke, I've got Pepsi, I've got Sprite, I've got orange juice, I've got cranberry juice. What will it be? And then he steps back, and I'm watching him stare at my eyes. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, this is one of those guys who took one of those sales courses. Because what he's going to do is if my eyes go up, and then I go side to side, and then I go down, if he extracts from me that my decision-making process is to make a picture, have a conversation, and then check out a feeling, then when the time comes to sell the car, he's going to say to me, just imagine how good you're going to look driving down the street in this car, telling yourself what a great deal you got on it, knowing in your gut that it was the right decision. Visual, auditory, kinesthetic. Right? He'll feed back to me my own decision-making process. So I thought, just for fun, I looked up, I looked down, I looked side to side, I looked up, I looked side to side, I looked up, I looked down, I looked side to side, I looked up. And at this point, this guy's starting to walk backwards. He's like, whoa, wait a minute. But there are some people who have these very, very, very complex decision-making strategies that don't serve them well. Sometimes, you know, in restaurants, for example, we have a friend who would, you know, you sit down in the restaurant, and by the time everybody else's food has come, she's just figured out what she wants off the menu, because every single item, she's applying the same decision-making strategy that she would apply to who shall I marry to what shall I have for lunch. I used to have a fairly complex decision-making strategy around restaurants as well, and Richard Bandler blew me out of it one day in London. I'll tell you the story of that when we come back from this break and how we can use that in the political arena. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone right here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Bush Sr. calls it, or otherwise known as Portland, Oregon.
Franken Show with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself,
and thanks so much to my producer David Pools, Louise Hartman, Alex Goldmark, Julian Sukman, Andrew Dunn, Clay Kaplis, Lauren Kirchner. Today, in particular, Andrew and Lauren at Air America, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt, and all the folks in our chat room. Hey! To everybody there. And Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you. So here's the story I was going to tell you. I was in London. Richard Bandler had said that he would write the foreword to a book that I'd written about NLP and, well, all this kind of stuff, and attention deficit disorder. It's called Healing ADD. And he said, but I'm not going to sit down and write it. He said, you bring a tape recorder over to London, and we'll sit down in a restaurant, and I'll dictate it. And I said, okay, fine. So I hopped on a plane and flew over to London. And he was teaching a workshop. And so we had, like, you know, 45 minutes or something for lunch. And so we walked 5-6 blocks down to this restaurant. We sit down. We don't have a lot of time.
Right.
We sit down. The waiter hands us a couple of menus. Bandler says, stick around, to the waiter. Stick around. And so the guy just stands there for a minute. Bandler just skims down through the menu really quickly. And then says, I'll have this. And he points to something on the menu. and hands it back to the guy. And I'm thinking, oh, he must have been here before. He must know what's on the menu. And I'm looking at things on the menu, and I'm making pictures in my head, and I'm having conversations, right? I'm looking at the, you know, well, what about that veggie burger? Well, I don't know. Maybe it's got gluten in it. Well, what about that? You know, well, this has cheese. I don't know. It's not good for my heart. And I'm having all these. And Bandler says, come on, Hartman, make up your mind. And I'm like, I only read like half the menu. And he's like, come on, we don't have all day here. Make up your damn mind. And so, you know, I just pointed at something. You know, if something looked good, I pointed at it, and I said, I'll take that. And so the waiter takes my menu, and he walks off kind of looking back at us like, whew, what's going on there? And Richard says, I'll bet you were sitting there thinking about things. You were making pictures in your head. You were having conversations with yourself. You were trying to decide what was good for you and what wasn't good for you and what was going to be tasty and all that kind of. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And he says, it's just lunch in a restaurant. And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, you need a different decision-making strategy. You need a simpler decision-making strategy for when you got to get a quick lunch. And I said, like what? And he says, well, I use biofeedback. And I was like, biofeedback? And he's like, yeah, I look at the menu, and whatever makes me salivate, I order. And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. He's like, yeah, that saliva, that's your biological system feeding back to you that it wants to eat something. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so I actually do that now. I look at a menu, and I notice what makes me salivate the most. And if it's not something that's totally outrageous or something outside the realm of what I will eat, that's what I order. It's really simple. So the moral of the story, is that we need to have a series of decision-making strategies. We individually, we all need to have, you know, multiple decision-making strategies, and most of us do. Highly functional people have quick, fast decision-making strategies for relatively unimportant things and long, drawn-out decision-making strategies for really important things. I have a friend who's a psychiatrist who teaches psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School who tells in public the story of how the first seven women that he dated, he asked each one of them to marry him. This is a guy who needed to learn, and ultimately did in his life, but needed to learn, and he tells the story in the context of having ADD, but really it's a story of not having a decision-making strategy for something really important. Not having ever, you know, sat down, paid attention, and learned how to have a multi-step decision-making strategy. And that's something, you know, as parents we want to teach our kids, and you know, as friends we may want to teach others. But the bottom line of all this is that at the end of every decision-making strategy, there is biofeedback. There is a feedback that comes back to us and says, yeah, that's the right decision. And it's always biological. It's always physical. If you think of any decisions that you've made in your life, particularly big important ones, but even small ones, there is some biological cue. Usually it's a gut feeling. I mean, it's literally a feeling of some kind. You may not even notice it. You may just have the words for it. You may say, yeah, I had a feeling that was the right thing. And think that you're speaking metaphor, but actually you're speaking literal truth. So what does this mean for promoting political change? What it means is that if we can interpret the territory into a map which contains the language of feeling, if we can cause people to have a positive feeling associated with the territory, then our communication will be effective. This isn't about convincing people that up is down. This is simply about being an effective communicator. We're talking about taking, you know, people who are incompetent communicators and making them competent communicators. You can't change somebody's mind in a way that's inconsistent with what's good for them ultimately. I mean, you might be able to for a short period of time, but over the long term it falls apart. Look at what's happening. You know, 26 years of conservative economics is disintegrating right in front of us. Because it's not good for us over the long term. So know that at the end, decisions are always made based on, oh yeah, that feels right. And so this is one of the reasons why George Bush, frankly, is a brilliant communicator, oddly enough, because he always talks at the level of feeling. And, you know, ideally that's where you'd end up. Where he's an incompetent communicator is he doesn't put in the pictures and the stories that lead to the feelings. And he doesn't do it in a whole way. But a feeling communicator will always beat an intellectual communicator any day. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, New Year's Day. I'll be live on Monday. Catch the fireworks. Tim Scheiderer, a conservative, is going to be on here with his 10 liberal lowlights for the New York Times in 2006. Yeah, right. And we're also going to be talking about the founders and the framers. What did they really have in mind for America, and what did they sacrifice to bring this country about? And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're in. Happy New Year's.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.